This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. For some artists, making art is about creating something distinct from everything else that came before. It's about producing something brand new. But in an exhibit on view at the Ackland Art Museum in Chapel Hill, 11 artists are exploring the flip side of that artistic impulse. Their work raises questions about the value of creating new objects and explores the ethical and environmental implications of this work. The exhibit is called Land of No Things. It's on view through the beginning of June, and we're going to get a preview today. Joining me first is the exhibit's curator, Chris Vitiello. He's a freelance photographer and an artist based in Durham. Hello, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Tell us about the curating this exhibit. What did you find a common theme among these 11 artists?
It's tricky to look at the work of 11 artists and come up with a line that kind of goes through all of them. But in conversations, it just seemed like everybody had a slightly different way of talking about the reasons behind making work. And it wasn't so much about the medium they're working in. You know, it wasn't like this exploration of paint. It wasn't a medium specific thing. It was more of a philosophical approach almost. You know, it's like, how do I make work that's relevant at a time when overproduction is ruining the environment, or the proliferation of just information that we're bombarded with is making individual pieces of information kind of lose their meaning. So they just had this impulse and almost a kind of ethical background to the making of any of their work.
Hence the land of no things, but what a challenge in a material world to produce material culture that argues against too much of materialism, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean it's a conundrum, right? You have things to express. You want to make work. You want to work with objects and with material, but you have to figure out a way to make work that is useful, is relevant after you release it into the world. So it's a cool problem they're solving.
One of the ways you can do that is to repurpose work, and the great repurposer of all times is our memory, where stuff resides and rattles around and finds its way out into the real world in one way or another. And to that end, we're joined now by one of the artists featured in the exhibit. Eric Pickersgill is a recent graduate of UNC Chapel Hill's MFA program, and he joins us now. Hello, Eric.
Hey, good afternoon.
Tell us a bit about your installation.
Well, the piece physically is about 50 feet wide, and it takes a wrapping journey, I suppose, around one of the corners of the gallery. And it's composed of about 60 different images that all came from sourcing my grandfather's 8mm films that he shot in the 1950s. And the piece does a lot of things as far as engaging with the idea of memory. But I think it also is telling of our real deep interest in kind of living forever. We have this impulse to record, you know, our daily experiences in a way that makes us feel like we're lasting.
You've got the images from the film that stretches all around the room, but also audio tape, a recording of your grandfather as well, that physically, because it's analog audio tape on a reel-to-reel machine, that physically stretches around the room as well, right?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So I actually had my grandfather I recorded audio of my grandfather reading lists that accompanied his films. I think that was a way for him to supplement the material that's in the films. And so I record him reading these lists and then asking a viewer questions at the same time. And I transferred it to a quarter-inch reel-to-reel player. And then I actually strung the tape out and pinned it to the wall to where it's physically moving around and underneath the piece. And the interesting thing for me about that kind of installation is the more times that tape follows that track, it's becoming less and less audible. It's essentially destroying itself as it plays. And I think that talks about the ephemeral nature of photography and also this kind of lust to live forever.
So you've got a mix on this tape of first him reading the list. This would have been a little sort of thing that he would have written on each can to tell him what was in it.
Correct.
And then him commenting on the film, and you kind of mix those two commentaries, one the reading of a list, the other him watching the film, together with this audio tape around the room. Well, let's get a sample of that right now.
1954 basic training maneuvers, Fort Bragg, Nancy Johnson engagement.
What are we looking at?
Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Is that
lecture,
the Eiffel
picnic.
Tower?
Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Who is that
parachute
on a horse?
Jump. Trip to California.
What?
California.
What is that I'm
when,
looking at when
year.
I walk by it?
Mom's birthday, March 1960.
Is that a
69.
Park?
Yeah, it's a clip from an installation piece by recent UNC Chapel Hill MFA grad Eric Pickersgill. His work is part of an exhibit at the Eklund Art Museum. It's called Land of No Things, and it really does explore, Eric, doesn't it, this connection between imagery and the way our memory works, which is not as linear as we'd like to think.
That's very true, yeah. And it's hard to, for me, listening to that piece, I have kind of a dual reaction to it in the studio here. We're all kind of like laughing, and there's a bit of humor to it. But there's also this sadness for me because my grandfather had a stroke about 7 years ago, which really affected his memory. And then the loss of my grandmother about 2 years ago is actually how I started mining these films again. And so it's great to spend time with him and work on a piece like this with him. But at the same time, it's kind of sad for me to think about that he had the impulse to record these things, and then now he really can't necessarily place a specific name to a person, or even with the list, he just can't really. It doesn't fully tell out the story.
It makes the piece itself all the more exquisite and sublime in many ways, because it looks at this aspiration of ours to maintain, to preserve, and knowing that whatever material it is, even if it's the material of the electrons that make up our memory and the chemicals, it will soon enough erode, and at some point it goes away, right? And yeah. This tape does as well. Interesting piece. Well, we're joined now by another artist who's featured in this exhibit. Katie Mixon is also a recent graduate at UNC Chapel Hill's MFA program, and she joins me now. Hello, Katie.
Hi.
Tell us about your piece.
So I have a couple paintings in the show. They're all oil on panel and made from this sort of regenerative studio process where I'm laying down sheets of oil in color on the panels and then carving back into them. So two of the pieces are what I refer to as seed paintings, where I'm carving out chips of paint that end up making new work. And so the other pieces in the show have been rebuilt from previous pieces.
So you take out these chips or seeds, you save those.
Right.
And so you've got one piece, which is an artwork with pieces of paint taken out, and then you'll create another work with those pieces of paint.
Exactly. So the studio is full of numerous clear acrylic boxes where it's sort of a paint archive that everything has been dated and based on size and painting and color. And it's a process in continuous motion where one thing is kind of making another.
And this business of seeds reflects your personal family background. You come from a farm, right?
That's right. Both of my parents are involved in agriculture and farming, and so it was a process that I sort of modeled after farmland and agriculture and, using kind of tilling the soil and harvesting and continuously trying to generate new life, I guess, from the same material.
Yeah, the ultimate in recycling, really,
right,
is putting the seeds back in the ground, right? And so that's your notion. I'm also told that you think about this in terms of the oral tradition, storytelling, and quilt making as well, right?
Yeah, that was actually one of the best experiences being in the UNC MFA program was kind of taking some classes over in the American Studies department. And I come from two grandmothers who were sewers and quilters, and in a sense, it's going in and creating my own scraps that I'm really working from in the studio, modeled kind of after that tradition.
When you look at your seeds project, this taking works of art, pieces of paint, repurposing them, making other works of art, and compare that to the project of creating food, you know, which is sustenance. I mean, how do those two things come together? How does art, something that we think of, you know, as like if it went away, we'd still eat, right?
Right.
And yet, there's something fun. There's something important enough about it for you to pursue the project. How do those two projects, farming and art, relate to you, or do they?
I think so. I think it's a different type of sustenance, maybe more emotional or spiritual or even psychological to a degree. It's certainly something that I need in order to sustain life. And I think, like many of the artists in the show, it's really sort of a model of how we can approach other things, whether it be memory or history or the land. You know, working out what that relationship can be, what is a productive and self-sustaining system. What does that look like?
And also, I think what this whole project and what the whole exhibit illustrates is that while art is a creative process and in many ways very individual and subjective, it's never done out of context. And so the ethical concerns about conservation and repurposing that you all bring to this are very much an important part of this art in this time and place. That brings us now to another featured artist in the exhibit. Geisha Werfel is a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill's MFA program, and she joins us now. Hello, Geisha.
Thank you. Hello.
You have on work display from two different series that you're working on. Let's start by talking about the Plantation Still Life series. Tell us about that.
So the Plantation Still Lives are part of a larger project called Oppressive Architecture. And with the Oppressive Architecture project, I'm exploring the aftermath of connections between American slavery and German Nazism in the area of forced labor systems, and also what impacts they have left on the contemporary landscape and its inhabitants. So, and I photographed plantations in the American South and concentration and labor camps in Germany. And so while photographing the plantations, I collected plant specimen as the new inhabitants of these spaces. And then I took them to the lighting studio as a way to dislocate them from their original place, the same that happened with the slaves that were brought to the American South to live and labor on these plantations.
And the people who were brought in concentration camps, and you have some evidence that there was some commerce and some study by particularly under the Nazi regime of American plantations to design concentration camps.
Yes, right? So I've been looking at Stanley Elkin's work, and he claims that the Nazi regime took inspiration from the plantation and slavery system, and they developed it through construction of labor and concentration camps. And apparently, according to Theodore Rosengarten, the Germans before World War One sent people to the post-Civil War area and to explore the gang labor system because they wanted to grow cotton in their West African colonies. And
It's particularly true in the Deep South, where in fact the plantation system had become an industrialized system. You had absentee landlords who created these giant industrial plantations in order to feed the textile industry, which was just going at an enormous rate in particularly in Great Britain. So this became an industrial. This was not people sitting on their porches drinking little umbrella drinks. A far different system that became very planned and thoughtful. So the idea of dislocating these plants and then photographing them, what do we get then? What do we get in these photographs of plants that have been sort of removed from their native spot?
Well, I mean, you will see the plant specimen that were all specific to the certain areas. Some were crops that were back then harvested by the slaves, like tobacco, for example, or sage or walnuts that were eaten, or pines that were used to construct slave cabins or the big house.
A second project is something called At the Hands of Persons Unknown. Tell us about that project.
So that's a project that combines photography, video, and a moving lamp. And so in the exhibition, I show two large-scale photographs and a video. And the work really explores how trees have been silent witnesses to the lynchings of women in the American South, especially during Reconstruction and the Jim Crow era. And in many cases, women were lynched alongside their husbands or sons or brothers.
And this is an interesting finding, and I wasn't aware of the number of women or the rate at which women were lynched in the South as well. Something that you found. And then trees as silent witness. So what do we see then in the exhibit?
So in the lynching video, that's about Harriet Finch's lynching outside Pittsburgh on September 28 in 1885, I shot the footage from the perspective of the lynching victim on the tree, so by moving the camera. And I rewrote the story based on newspaper accounts and also on the account of James Cameron, who survived his lynching in Marion, Indiana in 1930.
And you have a voice actor that reenacts part of that.
Yes, and it was read by Abigail Brooks Wright. So I would like to thank her for reading.
Sure, and that tape accompanies that. Let's take a listen to some of that tape.
I remember that day with horror. It was Monday, September 28th, 1885. I had been arrested just a few days ago. They told me I was accused of murder. I don't understand why. I didn't do anything wrong. The mob had already come a few weeks earlier to my house. They took me and swung me to a limb of a tree They were trying to make me talk. They suspended me twice. It was horrifying, but I swear I did not do anything wrong. And then, that September evening, I was looking out of the window of our cell, ready to go to sleep, hoping to go home soon. Then suddenly, I froze. Small groups of white men, 3, 5, 7 or more, kept coming into the jail. A few women among them kept coming closer and closer, closer and closer. They kept shouting, "We won't flinch, we won't flinch, we won't flinch." I watched, afraid, couldn't move a muscle. Then they had broke open the door, the mob shoved in, got closer and closer. They were hitting me, hitting us, fists, clubs, rocks, bricks. I was screaming, wailing, pleading, fighting back, but there were so many of them beating me. I was on the floor, didn't know what to do. It seemed like an eternity. They dragged us out of the cell, pushed us, I fell. They forced me to walk, I fell. They beat me on and on, never ending. And then, the tree.
That's a clip from a video produced by recent UNC Chapel Hill MFA grad Geisha Werfel at the hands of persons unknown, tells the story of a woman named Harriet Finch who was lynched in Pittsboro, North Carolina in the late 1800s. And Geisha, I know that you have shared this project and shown the video to a number of audiences. Tell us about the varied responses you get.
Usually everybody is very affected by the video. And
are they in different ways? I wonder if this plays differently to African-American audiences or white audiences. I don't know. Perhaps it plays the same way.
Well, I mean, I would think the African-American audience is definitely more affected by the video than the white audience, especially if the white audience was usually the mob or the onlookers. Right. But especially when I've shown the photograph to African-Americans, so the images, day long exposures where I've moved the camera and of trees, and they look abstract, almost like x-rays or ghosts. And usually African-Americans got the topic right away. They understood what it was about, whereas with the white audience, I usually had to explain a bit what the project is about.
I want to ask each of you what it's like. You've all done your own work, and now it gets curated in an exhibit around this frame of the idea of sort of how we repurpose and cope with material culture in this overflow of stuff. What's it like, Eric, to see your work now in this exhibit that's framed by others and surrounded by other work?
First of all, telling of how amazing Chris has been at selecting the work for this show. I have to give him credit. That was not an easy feat. It does change the work a little bit, and I think it speaks about the program itself. And for me, it reaffirms why I wanted to attend UNC's MFA program, because it is interdisciplinary, and there is this questioning of materials and mediums. As I came in as a kind of traditional documentary photographer, and then I'm leaving with more installation-based work that's mixed media. So seeing it side by side with students who have also had that kind of jump to a different medium or an approach. It's just exciting to see that.
Katie, does it change the way you see your work, seeing it around these others?
I think it has, actually. And even listening to Geisha and Eric speak about their own work, especially for me working with a much more abstract model, I think I've started to understand some of my own desire to make the work, and in a way that's through this sort of lens of, you know, looking at history and memory and what's being covered up or unearthed and uncovered, and how that relates to the other work in the show that's much more identity and regionally specific.
Katie Mixon, Eric Pickersgill, and Geisha Werfel are three recent graduates from UNC Chapel Hill's MFA program. Their work is part of an exhibit called The Land of No Things at the Ackland Art Museum. There are other artists whose work is shown as well, but I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Chris Vitiello, thank you, the curator of the exhibit. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Frank.
It's on exhibit at the Ackland through June 7th. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're joined by the editor and publisher of The Sun magazine, Cy Safransky, joins us to talk about 40 years of work. Stay tuned.